Welcome to our show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
Plato said that the unexamined life is not worth living, so Pat and I examine life a couple of times a month from many different viewpoints, and my focus is on human nature and trying to understand how it causes our actions and the things that happen in daily affairs.
And tonight we're going to talk about the how we're kind of repeating history. We're going to look at the decades of the 1930s and 40s, which changed us dramatically, socially as well as politically, and draw the parallels with a lot of things that are happening today.
We've been, our last show was on the 1900s, 1910s, and a little bit of the 20s. And Pat and I are planning to cover the whole century. Does sound pretty laborious, but it's fascinating to see how each decade and what happens in that decade affects the subsequent decades, and also the lessons that we did not learn and decide we want to repeat history for some reason.
And recently we repeated the crash. We called it the last time here a major recession, but it was almost a depression. And in the late 1920s, Wall Street created another depression by their fears. They actually, at the time, London had suffered a crash in their stock market. And our retailers were pressuring employees to work on Thanksgiving. And that was a big problem. Employees had always had it off in the past, and they did not want to work. They only worked half days if they had to work at all, and they didn't want to work on Thanksgiving. And the stock boys start feeling that there may be a strike during the busiest time of the year. And then the trust that used to hold huge amounts of stock, there were rumors going around that the trust were selling off shares. And those two rumors created all of the fear that caused the depression and a major event. It was all based on fear.
And of course, prior to that, there were several depressions in the 1800s and the early 1900s, but they didn't really have government intervention for all of our good and protection, so they didn't last very long. This one, we did get involved, our government did, and so it lasted 10 years.
But it was probably a good thing in a lot of ways that the government did get involved. They provided, in order to FDR's New Deal, he promised the public that there would be a New Deal for the people. And he provided, a lot of those programs provided money for business loans because business started closing rapidly and that caused unemployment, which is similar to what we just went through. And so the government said, okay, we'll make the $2 billion available in business loans, which is a little bit different than the bailout program we just went through, but similar.
Well, it just seems to me that we had that intervention in the Depression of 1929, 1930s, and it lasted 10 years, and we've had probably the most government support to protect us all from ourselves, and it's been about another 10 years. Amazing how that works. The government steps in to help us, and we have a recession that's still dragging its feet.
And a lot of the problems this time have not really been corrected. In the 1930s, we actually arrested bankers and sent them to jail. That's not happened this time. Those people who caused a lot of what happened with the big speculation in oddball securities are still doing it. They're just calling it something else. Where in the 1930s, we actually prosecuted people, the legal system did.
Well, I think that's just because the cronyism was started probably. It's always been around in one form or another. But in the 1930s, it wasn't as sophisticated. They've become much better at it now. And I don't think friends are going to send friends to jail.
Well, the other thing that happened in 1933, the Glass-Steagall Act, which I think was a good thing, it separated banking from brokerages. So the stockbrokers couldn't also be the bankers because those bankers often had their wool pulled over their eyes by frauds because of the drive that the brokerages had to sell big, huge amounts of stock.
And I think that, our what they're trying to tell us now is that we need to give them more ability to do, give the bankers and the stockbrokers more ability to do what they want. And the same thing kind of happened recently, didn't it, in our 2008 debacle, was that bankers had a bunch of loans that were bad, and they didn't bother to do their homework.
Well, there was a lot of margin trading and a lot of speculation into what we'd consider oddball securities that weren't available to the public. Wall Street was pushing those.
But weren't there also a lot of bad packages of mortgages that they bought?
Oh, yes, because banking had become part of the mortgage system again, because in the 1990s, they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated banking from stockbrokers. And the stockbrokers, over the last 15 years, they absorbed the banks one way or another, and we wound up with the same problem.
Well, there are some of us that feel that we needed to feel the pain of that so that people would be more discerning rather than expecting the government to protect them. So I guarantee you, whatever protections they came up with aren't going to protect us.
The other problem that we had that we've just recently gone through, and that is the high unemployment. That in 1933, when they started enacting a lot of these laws, we had 1.6 million people that were unemployed. And they had what they called the National Recovery Act, which was controlling industry, a minimum wage, working hours. And it was all to put those people back to work. But ironically, the Supreme Court struck that down as unconstitutional.
Well, I remember reading an article about that, and one of the things they were doing was choosing kind of like a most favored nation thing. They were choosing which companies were the best, the government was. And I remember that there were some tires, a new innovative tire that had been designed that was going to be less expensive, more durable, and they were not the Firestones and the other companies like that basically got them off where they couldn't get on that list. And so they weren't allowed to produce what they wanted to produce as part of that NRA.
Oh, well, that, and we also went off the gold standard, and there was a farm relief bill where we started to pay farmers not to produce certain kinds of food because the food got so cheap, because we had such an abundance of it that the farmers couldn't make a living.
And one thing we don't want during a depression is cheap food.
Right. So they started controlling, through the Farm Bill, controlling the farmers and what they grew. And that turned out to not be so good for other reasons. The Agricultural Department, with their great new ideas on farming, would strip the land totally down to the topsoil. So instead of turning old crop under the soil and letting it rot, the new agricultural idea was just, take the land back to its bare soil. And, that got us,
right.
The Dust Bowl.
And most of these programs, just because they're so large and they're run by people who aren't farmers, they always have unintended consequences. I cannot give you reasons why almost all government intervention is bad. All I can tell you is history proves it every time. But we continue to do it, thinking we can do it better.
Well, sometimes it's necessary, and it's a crisis situation. But I think if we looked at it with what they call the sunset clause in those bills, where at a certain time they die, then we would get rid of a lot of these bills that perpetuate themselves and become monstrosities.
But again, it's another thing I point out. I can't tell you why they don't die, but I can tell you they won't. They never do. They don't sunset the bills. They don't plan for all the contingencies they can. I don't have definite things I can lay down about why they should not intervene, in spite of the fact that they were saving us all from starving and all of that. It just never works. It never seems to be good for the country in the end.
Well, they did a lot of strange things then in the idea of controlling something or another that was not a positive impact on our society or politics or whatever. When we went off the gold standard, Roosevelt would pay $35 an ounce for gold because they wanted to get it out of the public hands. And they devalued the dollar down to 60 cents in idea of trying to control the economy.
I remember some of the things. I don't remember the details about their attempts to get the gold back and all the things that they did and the things that they frowned on, and so they could have control of all the gold to try to bolster the dollar a little more.
Well, it was all in, I don't want to say they were trying to control us so much as the spiraling economy and
right.
a business and all of those kinds of things, even social behavior. They tried to, you know, Germany was already starting to persecute Jews, and so they boycotted German goods thinking that they could force Germany into behaving. And that doesn't, I mean, it's kind of similar to sanctions today. We can, you know, put sanctions on a country. Back then, we boycotted traded goods like you talked about. And it wasn't necessarily because of our corporate local corporations that wanted to control that. It was we were trying to control the behavior of another country.
Right. And you just you can't control or legislate behavior. You to a certain extent, you know, we have a constitution. If you kill somebody, you go to prison. If you steal things, well, you don't go to prison anymore for that, but you used to. You know, those are fine, but trying to manage behavior or trying to manage ethics or something with a government is just not doable.
No, and I think you'd think we would have learned that by now, but we repeatedly tried to do that, and it doesn't work. It might have a small impact on some people, but by and large, we're all live inside our heads, and the little voice in there tells us what to do, what's right or wrong, not necessarily the government.
No, and I my belief is that freedom always works, that generally there will be people doing quote-unquote bad things, people doing quote-unquote good things. But in the end, the mix tends to work out, which is why the first couple hundred years of our country, things worked out very well. Because, you know, overall, there was a lot of pain, there were land barons, there were all these terrible things, and yet we became the most prosperous nation in the world through all of that. And then when we had a big depression, we tried to have the government step in and save us all, and it's just never been the same country since then.
And we probably had more laws and regulations set into motion in the 30s than any other decade. We started out things like the Social Security Act started out to help the old, the elderly, and women with children, because so during the Depression, so many men abandoned their families. They didn't have jobs, and so the family was left abandoned, and the only way they could get any kind of support for those kids was through the Social Security Act.
Yeah, I remember my father telling me he wasn't old enough to have a family, but a lot of men his age back then in the 30s went on the bum, and it was kind of like people traveling to Europe with their backpack these days, but it's something you did. You went on the bum, you hit the rails, and you went around and tried to find work when you could, and he used to brag that Al Capone gave him a quarter once when he came off a train, and you know, that was the way they coped with it, and he went into CCCs, and they him and his brother worked. I mean, people manage to find a way. If people are going to be hungry, they usually find a way to get food.
Well, interestingly, we also started things like smoking. Smoking had started out in the 20s and really taken off. And by the start of the 1930s, they made $11 billion in sales in cigarettes. This was like, you know, alcohol. The prohibition had prevented alcohol. It was like, okay, everyone smoke now.
I think a couple of things caused that to happen. One of them was that cigarettes, I believe in the 20s, weren't they? That's when it really became easy to get cigarettes that you didn't
yes.
have to roll.
I don't know when rolled cigarettes came out, but it must have been.
I think it was around that time. The other thing was we had the Roaring 20s, and it became more popular for women to smoke.
Yes, and it was a taboo to be seen in public smoking if you were a woman. But it was very acceptable at parties and clubs and all of that. So our social behavior was changing, and even though you might be poor, you found a way to either go to the movies, because it was the golden years of Hollywood then, or baseball. Babe Ruth, I think, was in the late 1920s, was the famous baseball player. You found money to go to there. And despite the fact that there were 4 million people unemployed in 1930. So in 1938, they passed the minimum wage law at 40 cents an hour out there, 40 cents an hour in 1938, because unemployment had jumped from 4 million to 8 million.
But I remember my father also bought our house for $8,000.
Yes, and you could go to the movies for a nickel. You know, it was a fabulous time socially as far as entertainment. There were a lot of choices. And like you say, if you need food, you find a way to get it. If you want to go to the movies, you find a way to go to the movies.
Right. Now, it's interesting how, going back just briefly to kind of the beginning, how we responded to tyranny, kind of our tyranny of royalty, by creating our Constitution and our, you know, our freedoms, trying to minimize government. And Russia in 1905 went the other way. They decided, you know, they had a tyranny of the royal, and they decided to go with communism. And I've always wondered, why was it that a societal thing, or why the two different approaches to royalty?
Well, the czars, I think Stalin had a lot of impact on that, because after World War One, the Bolshevik Revolution, which was about, let's say, socialism, if collectivism is probably a better term for it, but that was brought about with the idea that we'll get rid of the czar,
right,
and we'll have a socialistic type government where the public will all benefit rather than just the royal family or the czar.
That's kind of the same thing, you know, in America. It was just a different approach as to how to solve it. They were basically being beaten up by the royalty, who had England had everything, and they were trying to take everything from us. But I don't want to dwell on it. I was just curious about how we had the two different approaches, and we chose one and they chose the other. And Stalin, by the way, was really just kind of a soldier of the movement. He took over. We had Trotsky, then you had Lenin, you had those guys. Then they died.
Stalin, Lenin died young, yeah.
Yeah, Stalin essentially just kind of took the thing and ran with it. He was not all that bright, but he was very Machiavellian. He was good at... He wasn't politically astute in the beginning. He learned from the best, and he took power, but he did it with kind of a brute force approach.
And ironically, in Germany in 1930, they had some bank failures, and Stalin panicked and closed all the banks in Russia. He had collectivized agricultural and all the food supplies, and then the next thing he took over was banks. It was kind of like nationalizing, very similar to what Putin's done with oil industry in the last decade. Even though they supposedly were going democracy, now they're back to... collectivizing, you might say.
But I don't think democracy ever happened. You know, the reason Europe escaped from the Soviet Union is because they went broke, and a lot of people won't admit it. But Reagan was a good part of responsible for that with his totally fake Star Wars defense initiative. He broke them. They were trying to compete with that, and they couldn't because it didn't really exist.
Well, not only that, but Russia had closed its borders in the 1930s, and then it decided that, you know, it wanted to embrace capitalism on some level and thought it could do it in little tiny increments, only for Putin to turn around and close those doors totally now.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not even communism really anymore. It's just a dictatorship, essentially. But they're doing like the Romans did in the old days. They're making the people believe that they have some kind of democracy or something, and really... it's just a dictatorship masquerading.
Yes. And who better than that was doing that was Hitler. And in the 30s, he impacted the whole world. Both Stalin and Hitler impacted us, despite us not really getting into a war until the 40s. It was he was the chancellor, and he was granted, in 1933, he was granted dictatorial powers, and he started burning books. He opened concentration camps. He hated Jews, Marxists, anybody who he thought was not pure German.
Well, I think he used them. I don't think he really liked anybody, but he wasn't, you know, he came into power basically through the power of his speech. He was a very good speaker. But if you read his history as a young man, he was basically a loser. He couldn't accomplish anything he wanted to accomplish. And I think he found out by accident that he was a good speaker. He started haranguing people in a rooming house that he lived in because he couldn't make a living. And then he started haranguing people in beer halls, and he had a knack for speaking like someone else that we know. And he was able to finally, people wanted to use him to control things, to make his speeches and get people fired up.
And he did. When he became the dictator, he broke up trade unions. He controlled every aspect of life. He authorized the sterilization of Germans to purify the race. They killed gay people. They, put 45,000 Jews in camps.
Well, the way he came to power was because the Weimar, they were mismanaging the economy completely, plus coming off of a war that devastated them and all the concessions they had to pay and so on. They were broke.
World War I broke most of Europe, and they were starving.
But Germany was considered to be the bad guy, so everybody focused on them, and they were really damaged because of that. And it's not like it wasn't their fault, but that's what happened to them. And what Hitler said was, I can get you all your jobs back. And he did. I think he did show some brains in that he had a plan. He knew that if he could put them on a war footing against all the treaties, that he could, you know, get the economy moving, and he did. He put them on a war footing, and he took away from the rich. First, he used the rich to get what he wanted, and then when he'd gotten what he wanted, he took everything that they had, and he took from industry, and he gradually governmentalized all the industries. And by going directly to a war footing, he was able to revitalize the economy. It just wasn't a lasting thing that would have kept going.
And with his Nazi soldiers, and he indoctrinated children. He would take them away from their parents and literally indoctrinate kids. He also had the youth movement where these people, young people, were quasi-drafted into their military. And they really didn't know what was going on in the rest of Germany. They just knew what was going on in their individual lives as to what their duty was in the to purify Germany, to make it as pure as possible, to be pro-German about everything.
Well, some of them didn't, but a lot of the gangs that went around killing Jews and beating people up were the Hitler Youth. I just don't think, as you said, I think a lot of them didn't know what was being done in Hitler's name, but a lot of them did. They were probably the ones that became the leaders later on when they left the Hitler Youth.
Well, Nazis took kids even from Christian parents, and a lot of accounts have come forward of those youths who were in the military, in the Nazi regime, and they would have kids tell on their parents, and then those Nazis would tell that further up the ranks. And a lot of them came forward later and said they didn't understand that what they were passing on to powers that be caused the death of those people or caused them to be sent to the camps until they realized these people are disappearing after we tell on them.
We have a version of that now, but we have a name for it now. The people, the youth, when you watch them being interviewed, these are voting youth, and they clearly have no concept of what's happening in their government or their politics at all. But the parties that use them, we call them useful idiots. Because they can vote, and you can easily persuade them to do what you want without giving them a real sophisticated reason to do it.
But, here the Nazis had, or Hitler had a plan, and it smacks very similar to what Putin is doing now. And that
and the Ayatollahs.
Yes, that too. But he bombed Spain, okay, and he took Austria. And then Britain and Italy got together and said, well, we'll give you Czechoslovakia to make peace. And the Nazis took Prague after that. And then Poland. It wasn't ever going to appease them. It was just a matter of time that he would sign these agreements and these treaties saying that, okay, I believe you. We'll approve this, and we'll stand by it until the next year. And then it was on to the next.
And as you said, we have that today. We somehow have this feeling that the world is just full of wonderful people, and if we can just be nice enough to them, they'll be nice back. And we let them walk all over us. And these treaties, we know they're going to cheat on them. Unless you put teeth in something, there just are always going to be people that take advantage. Actually, most of us in one form or another take advantage of other people. It's just human nature. But a lot of us don't do it in such a mean way, and we're not trying to get everything from everybody else. But it's natural to look out for your own interests. And these people are just bigger and have more strong interests. And We somehow think that if we can just get this treaty, I don't even know why they're thinking this treaty will be a good thing. I don't get it.
A good example is in 1939, Germany and Russia signed a treaty that they would behave themselves. And the very next month, Hitler invaded Poland and gave half of it to Russia as an appeasement.
Well, I guess maybe people think now, or politicians think, or we're believing that just because it's a treaty, you just have to abide by it somehow.
And again, most of these people agreed to a treaty in trying to pacify Hitler or to get an alliance with a country that would then break it because they got influenced on another front. And so it doesn't hold a lot of water historically that these treaties will hold water. We have some good examples, you know, NATO. But we have so many more poor examples of treaties and how they don't hold up over time.
And even NATO has deteriorated. They always do, because all that stuff becomes suffused with self-interest. And we just, any treaty that's going to work is one that's backed by potential force. And a lot of people don't like the fact that we are strong enough to be the policemen of the world. And I agree, empire building is the worst thing we can do. But policing the world is not a horrible thing. I mean, we believe we need police in our country, but somehow we think the world doesn't need a strong police presence. And we don't, you know, we conquered, or could have easily conquered, France, Britain. We had everybody at our, you know, we won the war. We won World War II. We didn't take those countries. We may have left some military presence, but we gave the countries back, even the enemies. We're not an empire like people think.
Well, then, and we've gone along the sanction route, which is sort of, you know, we want you to do what we want you to do, and we're going to take away something from you, and that doesn't always work. FDR asked dictators of Europe for a 10-year peace, and they all just fanned their nose at us. You know, we weren't on the world stage at the time. Hitler was, Russia was, even England was more on the world stage than we were, and they just fanned their nose at us. You
right.
Asked for a peace. Good luck with that.
That was kind of our, World War II was our coming of age.
Yes.
We even World War I was not, we became a world power, but World War II, we showed them what we could do in a short time.
Yes.
And you know, we have our fleets around the world because we're bordered by two oceans and a sea.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to have our Navy out there protecting us. I don't get the idea that we're an empire.
Interestingly, you talk about ships. 1939 that got Britain and France to declare war on Germany was Germany sank a British passenger ship.
Right.
Does this not sound like when Putin shot down the passenger airline over Ukraine?
Oh, yeah. Your thesis is correct. We are repeating today the errors of the 1930s. I don't know where they'll lead us to, but we are definitely making the same judgmental mistakes about people. We're going to have to take a break. It's already at the just about at the half hour. This is Examine Life on KKRN 88.5 FM on your dial. I'm Steve.
I'm Pat.
And we're talking about the 20th century over this previous program and the next few, and we're on the 1930s and possibly the 40s tonight. We'll see what we can do. I get a little carried away, and I think Pat sometimes does too. But we'll be back shortly.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on. And my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. A kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me. And my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part. A kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Making believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener-supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
This is Examine Life. I'm Pat.
I'm Steve.
And tonight we're talking about the decades of the 30s and 40s and how they impacted us. But before we go much further, I want to talk about the Whitmore Mountain Music Fair. And this is put on by the Whitmore Volunteer Fire Company. And it is May 9th. It's also has a motorcycle polka run, which is really fun. They do that a lot with antique cars. And they will have a classic car parade up there. They have a band that's live music, and the poker run is free. And the parade lineup and poker registration is at 9 o'clock. So if you want to have fun on the 9th, go on up to Whitmore.
And I briefly want to talk about something. We on the radio station sometimes have internal discussions about things that we want to put on the radio, and we really need your input. We're a small community station, and we don't have the kind of demographic tools that a lot of stations have. We need input from the community, from Round Mountain, from the local area, from Redding, anyone who's listening. Our program is examinelife at kkrn.org is our email, but contact the station about any of the shows you hear or things that you would like us to put on the air, and let us know. That's what community radio means.
We are your community radio. Tonight we're going to talk about, in the beginning of 1930, we repealed Prohibition. It had impacted us socially dramatically, and the mob had taken over all of the speakeasies.
Another unintended consequences of a government law.
Yes, and the crime was just impossible. Capone went to prison. The Bonnie and Clyde were finally arrested in the 30s. It went on and on and on. The G-men were killing a lot of these Dillingers, Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd. They were all killed by the G-men, which were government men.
Yeah. As is happening today, basically Prohibition funded organized crime and made it bigger and stronger and all the way through to today.
And think about it. Now it's drugs. It is organized crime, basically run by the drug cartels.
I remember a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, when Britain tried a punitive tax on cigarettes. They started a new underworld for selling cigarettes.
Yes, and we had the black market. They were called speakeasies for whiskey. And it got out of control, and the mob took control of all the speakeasies. And the crime, everybody, we're talking about innocent civilians getting killed on the streets by drive-by shootings, but these were with machine guns.
But I think one of the positive cultural aspects of the 1930s, and especially the 40s, which we'll get to later, was the movies.
Absolutely.
When Hollywood was coming into its own, and they realized what they could do with film, both with special effects. You know, even back in the 20s, late 20s, they made those movies like Things to Come. They were even doing science fiction way back then. But the dramas that they did and the political dramas, you know, of the courtroom and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which was later. But they were just the movies set the tone of the time starting with the 30s. Before that, they didn't have that.
No, and in the 30s, 22 million people went to the movies as an escape. And you could actually go to the movies, see a cartoon, see a newsreel, and another movie for a nickel.
Right, and it was just, and again, the movies were so great. Today they're great. A lot of people think because they're more raw, they have a lot of sex and things, that today's movies are terrible, and they're not. They're wonderful.
And it gave birth to the Kodak camera, where you could take a picture at home and go and take the film in and get it developed. And color was discovered in the 1930s as well, color film.
Right. Yeah, that was, and when I look back at our pictures, and now you notice it's kind of stylish to take black and white pictures. Whenever you see photographic art, it's usually not in color. I should say much of it is not in color. And that black and white adds to its artistic appeal.
And we had great scientific things going on there. They invented the first artificial heart chamber, which we now call the heart-lung machine, but it was to have somebody's heart and lung be working while the patient was under an operation.
Right, yeah, it simulates the what the lungs do and what the heart does. It basically reroutes the blood through this machine instead of through your heart while they're working on your heart.
And interestingly, the Dust Bowl created a phenomenon of what they called lung pneumonia or dust pneumonia that was an epidemic then.
You still have some versions like bird fancier's disease. People that have a lot of birds in their house can end up with a severe form of pulmonary fibrosis, which probably what a lot of the dust storms did to people.
Science also discovered that there are certain essential nutrients that animals need for reproduction, and they started naming them, and that's when they named vitamin E, vitamin B1, D, A, and C were all created or identified in the 1930s as essential nutrients that animals needed for life. And that's when they start coming out with the identifying markers.
And then the atom splitting in 1939 and what atomic energy did. And of course, a lot of people talk about how America was the leader in atomic energy, and so we were evil and blew up cities. But you know what? We've been the primary atomic force in the world since the 1940s. Have you seen any other countries being blown up?
No.
Do you think Iran would be able to say the same?
Yes. We've had enormous restraint, both us and Russia. Either one of us could have done that, and neither country did.
That's right. And so there's a lot to be said for America. You know,
yes.
I think Russia would say that they held us at bay. We would say that we held them at bay. You can take whichever opinion you want. All I can say is after we broke Russia, they still had nuclear weapons, but we had all of the power, and we still didn't bomb anybody or threaten them with nuclear weapons. America's a wonderful place.
Yes, it is. And on the fanciful side, that's when the VW bug came out, was also in the 30s. The swing dance became popular, and the big bands were starting to become of age. And it was a great time if you were young.
There was an interesting movie made a few years ago called Swing Kids, and it had an interesting cultural approach. Apparently in the 30s, as Hitler was taking power, his party hated American swing music. And the movie is about a bunch of a bunch of German youth who loved American swing and had a whole subculture. And if you get a chance to watch that movie, it's a fascinating show to watch. A lot of good swing music and dancing in it. And it's about those youth being, persecuted by the Nazi Party.
And it's kind of similar to Russia in the 1990s when they were all trying to get Levi's, American-made Levi's.
Right. The Volkswagen Bug, I had one of those in 1961. And there was a funny, I used to like the, I can't think of his name now, Woody Allen. He made a movie, a sci-fi comedy called Sleeper. And in the movie, he sleeps for 100 years and he wakes up and he's in the future. And he's trying to escape from the bad, evil government at the time. And he comes to this cave and there's a Volkswagen Bug in there that's been there for 100 years and starts right up. And that's the reputation they had. And that's what they were making fun of is, boy, these things are really good cars. The lights came on, the car started up, and they drove off.
And now Japan dominates that market.
Yeah. Yeah.
But interestingly, Japan wasn't idle back then in the 30s either. They bombed Shanghai, and that's what united Mao Zedong in China, was against Japan.
Right. They were you know, vying between him and Chiang Kai-shek, and Japan's interference changed that dynamic. And where we weren't involved that much in Europe during those pre-World War II times, we were involved with Japan politically. They wanted a different presence in the Pacific, and we didn't want them to have it. And that's what eventually led to them attacking us. It was really just a our bureaucratic system was just too slow in responding to some of the things. It wasn't really, it appears from history that I read, it wasn't really that we were being evil with them. We just, our diplomatic process was the typical political, you know, maneuvering. And so we didn't get back to them quickly enough on a crucial document. And that's ultimately why they made the final decision to go ahead, because they thought we were going to bomb them. Just because we weren't getting back to them.
And in 1940, Japan signed an agreement with Germany and Italy to create a new world order. So they were very active on the side of Europe.
Right. They were doing it essentially because they knew that they were going to be tackling a pretty good size giant, and they wanted to have that ally.
And by then, Britain and France had already declared war on Germany, and FDR had lifted the embargo on shipping arms to Europe. We then started shipping our arms, similar to what we're doing now in the Middle East.
And there was a book I read called, I believe it was The Rising Sun, and it was about World War II from the side of the Japanese. And they still had their military, especially the lower echelons, still had a lot of the samurai in their culture. And the lower military wanted to attack America much before the upper military and the government wanted to do it. They believed we should do it. They believed they were being dishonored by us.
Yes, and we were vacillating still about what was happening in Europe.
Right.
And we were kind of had an isolation attitude, and I don't know that it would have maintained had we not been attacked. We might have been able to pull that off, but the Nazis had entered Scandinavia, and the Prime Minister Churchill, that's when he became Prime Minister. They actually, England squeezed out the previous Prime Minister. His name was Chamberlain. Because he was trying to pacify Hitler, and they found that that was not working. And eventually, Joseph Kennedy lost his ambassadorship to England for the same reason.
Right. Yeah, I don't know much about that particular history, but I know that I don't understand what Chamberlain's, other than maybe he just wasn't an aggressive person and thought we could just be nice and avoid war. You know, if you've got a neighborhood bully, and he wants to pick on you, you're not going to avoid a fight. But if you punch him in the nose, there's a better likelihood that you will avoid a fight than if you just let him push you around, because they enjoy that. Hitler enjoyed that. You know, Japan had their own reasons. They believed we were dishonorable. So, because again, a lot of their military had these samurai cultures in them. But you can't, the world will always have bullies. And I don't see why some people cannot get that.
And when war was finally declared in Europe, FDR appealed to Mussolini to help halt the war there. And when that didn't work, then we sent 50,000 pilots to support England and France. But our military was not going there, but we sent these pilots to help. Does this not sound like our advisors in Iraq today,
well,
or Syria or wherever?
As far as going to Mussolini to help us somehow stop the problem that he was part of is kind of like us going to our politicians to make laws to protect us from lobbyists.
Or again, the Saudi Arabia, Iran, Yemen kind of, we're against them over here, but we're for them over there. It's the same kind of mishmash of loyalties.
Yeah, I don't get our foreign policy at all today. It's probably another discussion, but you're right. It's repeating what we did in the 30s. So if we learned anything from the 30s, it apparently is that history doesn't repeat itself somehow.
And interestingly, in 1941, Italy and Germany went to Libya. To occupy Libya,
yeah.
At Tripoli, there again, that famous city that we have gone back to when the pirates in the 1800s were stealing our ships.
Right. You know, I there is some, you know, it's misguided and warped, in my opinion, the business about how we've treated the Arab world. But there is some truth in that all of the developed world, Britain, Germany, America, we all, in World War One and Two, we made certain promises to Arab nations. They weren't in ascendancy. We were, so we had the power. We said, you help us, we'll help you later. And we always reneged on those. So they had a reason to be angry. That doesn't mean we should let them do what they're doing or we should accommodate their being angry. But, you know, they had, an excuse.
Well, and they even have that same relationship with Britain. Britain, there was civil war in Iraq, and Britain, in defense of their oil fields there, they put down that uprising in Iraq back then.
Right, right. Yeah, they were still, even then, a little bit of a colonial country. And they still, it took them a long time to really just divest themselves of that kind of thing. And there's still leftovers. I mean, Hong Kong was one of the last things.
Well, we kind of suspected there was going to be war. We thought it was going to be Europe, and we instituted the first draft where numbers were starting to be picked. And the Jeep, it was made by Willie Company, I believe.
Willie's.
And that Jeep was made for the Army, but it became the love of America. They thought that was one of the great things that had come out of our industries.
Oh, my son-in-law has an old 1950s, I think, Willie's Jeep. Very proud of it. He's bringing it back to life.
Yes, like a typical classic car. We also, just as we entered the decade of the 40s, FDR created wage and price controls because in anticipation of war that it was impacting our economy by the trade with Europe already. And we had what we called the national emergency declared so that the government could control wages, labor, anything they considered national defense purposes, which is very similar today to national security purposes.
Mm-hmm.
The similarities just are too strong in those decades.
And they don't like to let go of those controls once they have them in place.
And it was all based on these supplies were needed to go to Europe, or we needed to prevent oil shipments to Japan because we needed that oil here. In fact, they rationed gasoline, rationed butters, food. A lot of things were rationed and controlled by the government. And it was all under the idea of it was national emergency for defense purposes.
Right. And again, they don't give those things up. There's controls on everything now.
And Hitler was sinking ships. He was not particular. If you were in the Atlantic Ocean, your ship could get sunk. And so a lot of the goods, the trade goods, were actually being lost at sea, and they would never get here, or ours would never get over there.
Oh, yeah, great deal, the wolf packs. Germany was, they were out to conquer the world. And people don't realize why we call it the greatest generation, because no one's a student of history anymore. That's why you have things like Waters World on TV that shows you how ignorant our populace is, because they just don't pay attention. They don't understand history, and they don't understand that the greatest generation wasn't like Vietnam. They protected our nation from going away.
Yes, and it was on all levels. We bonded together during the war as a society, and at first it was against Hitler because that's whom we thought we were going to go to war with. But we signed a charter with England agreeing to make no territorial changes to lands occupied in Europe after the war, thinking that, you know, we would be successful and England would be on our side, and those peoples would be able to choose the government that they wanted. Russia did not stand up to that, but you know, we thought we were going to go to war with Hitler, when in fact we went to war with Japan first.
Right, right. Japan solved that dilemma for us.
And they were on the march. Japan was going into Singapore and Manila, and they found that the POWs that went to Japan were just brutalized. And that was our first true idea of brutality done to our own soldiers rather than like what Hitler was doing to his own people.
Right. And in their defense, the Japanese were very brutal. And some of the things they did were just animal in nature. But a lot of the brutality that they did put on our soldiers in and after battles was because they, when you had a group of them that were starving and were completely beaten and were given an avenue to escape by their own government, they refused it because they believed in honor. So a lot of the brutality they did to our soldiers, not to the things they did to the populace is unexcusable, but to our soldiers, they believed our soldiers to not be samurai. And they didn't put it that way, but that was the culture, that our soldiers would surrender. And they considered that to be basically you weren't worth saving. If you were willing to surrender, then you were a non-person. And they brutalized you because they dishonored you.
Right. And then we really, one of our other black eyes is when we put Japanese Americans. We rounded them up and put them in a form of camp in fear that they were spies because the U.S. FBI had caught hundreds of German spies, and we assumed there were hundreds of Japanese spies here, when in fact they weren't. Like,
they weren't, and that was a black eye. That was a typical government overreaction to things. We do it in many other ways besides wartime, but that was definitely a horrible thing to do to those people.
And that impacted our society. It impacted all of us mentally about how peoples could be so cruel to other peoples, even as POWs or our own, you know, a friend that you might know who was of Japanese descent who was taken away to this internment camp for no obvious reason. And the people there were not treated with respect. And that was a coming of age for us as Americans, that we were pretty naive about that in the rest of the world.
And it was a racist thing. I mean, the only reason because some of the people, when you look at the individual tales, they weren't Japanese. They were Oriental. And yet they were still harassed by people.
Yes.
Just like down in Anderson, they have a Sikh temple down there. And there are these people who just don't like any other religion or any other group. And they assume that they're Arabs. It amazes me. Mm-hmm. When you hear some people talk about that temple, they think it's some kind of a mosque. And it's not.
Ignorance.
But people, it's bigotry.
And it's ignorance. And we fear what we don't know or understand. And that's where it comes from. And that's where bigotry comes from, is fear of what we don't know or understand.
And the not having the desire to learn about it, so you know at least what you're fearing. But I digress. We're trying to get through the 1930s, and we only have a few minutes
left.
We're
into the 40s now.
We already got
Pearl Harbor. And
and the movies of the 40s were really great.
Yes.
And the zoot suits and the... I just love the 40s.
And we were doing war movies then, too. So they were very popular because we were getting news from Europe. So you were getting news about the war. And so there were more and more war movies that were very popular.
Right. And the music and everything. I mean, war is a horrible thing. But I think it brought just a life to the 40s.
It did to the movies.
Yeah.
But ironically, the UN was created in 1944, just before Pearl Harbor bombed us, and it was a pact between China, Russia, Great Britain, and us. So it was kind of ironic that just a couple of months later that Japan would bomb us. And then in 45, Germany surrendered. It wasn't even a year after we entered the war that they surrendered.
Right. Well, no, we entered the war in 1941.
Well, I meant Japan. Yeah, I'm sorry, 5 years later that they surrendered. And because of the UN, they tried to split up Germany into four sections, and that's how we got Berlin split up between Russia and the U.S. And when nations fall and there's a vacuum in power, somebody moves in, and it's somebody who's more powerful. And that's how Russia absorbed Poland. They wouldn't allow elections in Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, and not having elections prevented any government to be created. And thus, Russia just took over all of Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I and that's human nature. That's what has happened throughout history, and it's what will continue to happen until somehow we become biochemically not human, because it's all part of our natural heritage to be that way in varying degrees. We don't go out and invade nations, all of us. But some will always be there who do. And when you have a vacuum like that, you need to do something to fill it. And we, you know, by breaking up Germany, you could say we all were participant in that. I'd like to think that we did good things for Germany, because the people in Russia's side wanted the wall down. The people on the other side were happy.
Yes, and there were many, many people killed in Berlin just trying to get from one side to the other, because families were split by an arbitrary line.
Right. I've met some of those people, and they were willing to go through great privation to get out.
Yes. And Ho Chi Minh took control of Vietnam back then.
Yeah.
And we, Russia and the U.S., tried to take Korea, and we wound up with North and South Korea, which would eventually lead to another war,
yep.
Ironically.
Well, you know, people don't want to believe that wartime is a natural state, but I haven't seen any history that says that's not true yet.
And it was true in the Middle East, too. The Arab League was created in the mid-1940s with Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and they declared there would never be a Jewish state. And within a couple of years, there was, because 30% of the population of Palestine were Jewish.
Right.
So that was inevitable.
Yeah, they had to do something, and they've been persecuted by so many different societies.
And finally, in May of 1948, Israel was created, and Russia and America were the first countries to acknowledge them as a state.
Right. And they showed some other people, even though they had American financial backing, they won the Six-Day War with being tough.
Yes. And like I say, they were 30% of the population, and the Arabs, the 70%, they managed to, you know, wrestle away at least a patch of dirt for themselves in
right.
the Middle East.
And even today, the Arabs that live in Israel apparently don't feel trodden on. You know, they're happy there. The ones in Palestine do, but the ones who live in Israel seem to be happy living there.
Yes, and they are under a terrible cloud of constant war, and I don't know that there is a solution to the Middle East with such deep hatred.
I'm surprised that the Jews that I know, that I've communicated with in Israel, are so optimistic, considering what they've been living under since, 1948 or whenever it mm-hmm. was. They're just so optimistic and so patriotic, and so that's an amazing people.
Yes. And I think we're about out of time.
Well, we have a couple more minutes, a minute and a half.
Okay, then let's talk about the other things that happened. We created the World Bank and the IMF during the 1940s.
And, yes.
And they also disclosed to us about Los Alamos and the Manhattan Project. After it was all done and said, we only spent $2 billion to create that.
Right. But some great, some other great science other than atomics came out of those. Some of the physicists that came up with quantum physics and some of the technologies that we have today came out of the science that was done that has nothing to do with atomics, but was created during those to try to get the atomic bomb. Of course, war, as horrible as it is, always produces great technology because you have an urgent need.
And look at all the products that came. I mean, we had taken and melted down anything that was metal because metal was so hard to come by, but we increased the life of rubber because it was in such high demand for Jeeps and things like that, that we had to make it better. And so the technology led to better and better products that we got the benefit of as consumers in the 50s.
Right. And if someone had needed to know where to drop a shell more accurately in wartime, we wouldn't probably have computers evolved to the state they are today.
And England introduced radar back then. That's how they guided warships.
Right. Yeah, that's a part of what saved them. It wasn't as big a hope as we would have expected it to be, but they did invent radar, and it baffled the Germans as to how they knew that they were coming.
And we also pulled together as a nation. We bought war bonds. It was a form of savings for us, but it also was buying into our own government.
And the 40s was the beginning of some of the greatest corny science fiction movies of all time.
Yes, and the golden years of Hollywood were considered the 20s, 30s, and 40s. That's when they created the most memorable movies. We had the stars that are iconic now, and it was a totally different time.
And the you had the science fiction, the King Kongs, and the Invaders from Mars, and all these movies that were not sophisticated at all, and you had all this wonderful drama, and now You have the melding of the two, and you have this great science fiction with wonderful drama and vice versa.
And animation and special effects, all of that came from the movies.
Came from the movies in the 1930s and 40s.
Yes, and I think that wraps it up for this evening. And we will try and address the 1950s and 60s in the next show, which we talk about the impact of society and politics. And think about everything we've said tonight and how that has affected you, your family, and how you look at politics or how you look at society. And that's how, where you see the impact of decades prior to us.
Right. Yeah. It's part of examining life. You have to look at what motivates people and how their actions create other motivations.